afternoon or good morning to those of you in the West. Welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Laura Feast and I will moderate today's seminar. Today's topic is climate change. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Today we'll have three presentations, the first given by Rob Ritter of the Federal Highway Administration Office of Planning, Environment, and Realty. The second presentation will be given by Rob Hyman of Cambridge Systematics. And the final presentation will be given by Alan Clark of the Houston-Galveston Area Council. Rob Ritter was recently selected as the team leader of the Sustainable Transport and Climate Change Team in the Federal Highway Administration's Office of Human and Natural Environment. The Climate Change Team provides leadership and policy development on climate change mitigation, climate change adaptation, and sustainability issues. The team works throughout DOT and with other federal agencies on research and education initiatives and provides outreach, education, and technical assistance to FHWA offices, departments of transportation, and other stakeholders. Prior to moving to the Sustainable Transport and Climate Change Team, Rob spent more than 6 years as a team leader in FHWA's Office of Planning. He's a licensed professional engineer and certified planner with experience in both private and public transportation agencies. Rob Hyman has worked for Cambridge Systematics since 2002 on a variety of transportation issues, with a particular focus on air quality and climate change, from both the emissions reduction and adaptation perspectives. He is a co-author on the Gulf Coast study on which he will be presenting today. Mr. Hyman holds master's degrees in civil and environmental engineering and also in technology and policy from MIT, and a BA in earth and planetary sciences from Harvard University. Alan Clark is the Director of Transportation Planning for the Houston-Galveston Area Council. He is the Director of the Houston-Galveston Area Council's Metropolitan Planning Organization, which is responsible for the development of the region's multimodal transportation plans. The MPO's Transportation Policy Council approves the programming of all federal highway and transit funds in Harris and the adjacent seven counties. Mr. Clark's responsibilities also include coordinating the area's response to mandates contained in the Clear Air Act amendments of 1990. In 2005, Mr. Clark was named a member of the Transportation Research Board's Policy Study Committee on Climate Change in the U.S. Transportation. In 2006, Mr. Clark was also appointed to the Federal Advisory Committee on Impacts of Climate Variability and Change on Transportation Systems and Infrastructure Gulf Coast Case Study. He is currently a member of the National Academy of Sciences Oversight Committee of the Second Strategic Highway Research Program. Joining Alan is Amy Boyers. Amy will be on the line to answer questions you may have. Amy is a senior environmental planner with HGAC. Ms. Boyers has 10 years of experience in the environmental field. Her projects include extensive coordination with local governments on environmental enforcement issues and source reduction and recycling projects, administration of state solid waste grants, and coordination of non-point source pollution education workshops. In 2008, Ms. Boyer served as a lead staff for the HGAC Foresight Panel on Environmental Effects, which involved working with local governments and academia to develop policy recommendations for climate change adaptation. Prior to her work at HGAC, Ms. Boyer had 2 years of environmental consulting experience conducting Phase 1 environmental site assessments for public and private clients and producing NEPA documents for the Texas Department of Transportation and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with the 60 minutes allocated for the speakers and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, you can type it into the smaller text box underneath the chat area on the lower right side of your screen. Please make sure you are typing in the thin text box and not the large white area. Please also make sure you send your questions to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. Presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I will start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all of the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give you instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. The listserv is an email list and is a great forum for the distribution of information and a place where you can post questions to find out what other subscribers have learned in the area of freight planning. If you have not already joined the listserv, the web address at which you can register is provided on the slide on your screen. Finally, I would like to remind you that this session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and visual portion of this seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next week. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have not been able to attend this seminar to access the recording. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next week. I will notify all attendees of the availability of the PowerPoints, the recording, and a transcript from the seminar. We're now going to go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is climate change. Our first presentation will be given by Rob Ritter of the Federal Highway Administration. The second presentation will be given by Rob Hyman of Cambridge Systematics, and our final presentation will be given by Alan Clark of the Houston-Galveston Area Council. As a reminder, if you have questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box, and they will be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. Okay, Rob, let's pull up your presentation.
Thank you, Laura. Welcome, everybody, and I appreciate your attendance and attention this afternoon or this morning for those of you in the West. I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about freight and climate change and why Federal Highway is concerned about climate change. Just a few statistics to get started. It's important to recognize that transportation's contribution to greenhouse gas emissions is pretty significant. Transportation is the second largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S., and our highway system produces about 5% of all of the CO2 emissions in the world. We're a pretty significant portion of this issue. And of course, our concern is not only the emissions that we produce, but also the impacts on all of the transportation infrastructure that we expect from climate change. Focusing in a little bit on the freight modes, passenger modes in the U.S. produce about 3/4 of our greenhouse gas emissions. Freight modes are responsible for about 1/4 of that. 20% from trucking, 20% of all the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions from trucking, 2.5% from freight, and smaller percentages from ships and pipelines and aircraft. Most of that emissions has remained relatively stable over the last few years, although greenhouse gases from passenger cars and light-duty trucks has declined slightly, and from medium and heavy-duty trucks has increased slightly over the last year. What can be done to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? That's the first question we need to answer, the first thing we need to take a look at when considering the climate change issue. And there are a number of strategies. All of these are being investigated and evaluated simultaneously, but we usually refer to a four-legged stool when we're talking about greenhouse gas emissions. We can do things in four different categories. We can raise the vehicle energy efficiency, and you've heard a lot of public national debate on that. We can change the carbon content of fuels so that the fuels that we're burning is releasing less carbon into the air. We can reduce VMT, and by that I really mean reduce the growth of vehicle miles traveled that we expect to happen in the future, and improve vehicle and system operations. All four of those legs of the stool are going to be important in order to achieve our goals. But vehicle technology and fuels, where you might have heard most of the debate, are only going to get us to the portion of the emission reductions that we need to meet our targets. And especially at the Federal Highway Administration, we're really focused on reducing the growth in VMT and improving vehicle systems and operations by creating more compact land uses so people and jobs and recreation are closer together, shifting to more energy efficient modes, whether that's on the passenger side or on the freight side, increasing funding for transit and interpassenger rail, and promoting non-motorized strategies. This chart is to indicate that we need to do more than just the first two legs of the stool. If you look at the blue line on this chart, that's projected carbon dioxide emissions with the CAFE standards that are already in place. The green line at the bottom is the target that we really need to meet. That's sort of an internationally accepted target of what we need to accomplish by 2030 in order to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. You can see that VMT is projected to continue to grow, and VMT growth will overwhelm all of the other reductions in CO2 we achieve from the other legs of the stool. So if we were not to do anything about VMT, we'd manage to improve based on the other legs of the stool, based on fuel efficiency, on vehicle and energy efficiency, but all of that, those improvements would be overwhelmed by the growth in VMT. So we need to address that issue as well. The other reason that we care at Federal Highway and on the transportation side is the potential for costly impacts to our infrastructure. We manage, oversee, maintain, care about a tremendously broad and varied transportation infrastructure system throughout the United States. It's essential to our nation and our economy, and it is threatened by the impacts of climate change. Federal Highway has led studies of impacts on transportation, including the Gulf Coast study that Rob Hyman's going to give you more detail on in a few minutes, study on sea level rise in the East Coast, and working with the DOT Center on Climate Change, we've supported recent Transportation Research Board studies on impacts and adaptation. These studies have all shown that as the climate changes, our infrastructure will have to evolve to handle new conditions. I've talked about both sides of the climate change coin so far, but really to summarize it and make it clear here, mitigation and adaptation are really the two issues. Mitigation is the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, and without mitigation, we're going to see higher sea levels, higher temperatures and climate impacts and flooding, pavement deterioration. Adaptation is actions that we can take to avoid, withstand, or in some cases take advantage of current and projected climate changes and impacts. Adaptation decreases the system's vulnerability or its resilience to impacts. And that's a really another part of the issue that we need to consider. There's been a lot of discussion and debate about climate change and a lot on the mitigation side of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but we really also need to focus on adaptation. What we can do now to prepare for the climate changes that we know are going to come and the ones that we suspect we'll be seeing in the next 50 to 100 years. These climate effects could vary by region, and they could include higher sea levels for our coastal areas due to sea level rise and in some areas for due to the sinking of the land, increased storm surges from hurricanes, more intense and varied precipitation, changes in temperature, which include increases in both the average and temperature as well as high temperatures, increases in the number of hot days, stronger winds, changes in freeze-thaw cycles. All of these effects have implications to our transportation infrastructure. Some of these impacts might mean a permanent inundation of roads and bridge approaches due to sea level rise, weakening of the land or substructure due to either storm surge or precipitation changes, temporary flooding of roads, increased stream flow, erosion, and bridge scour, which we need to prepare for in our designs and our maintenance, pavement cracking, deformation, sun kinks in rails. All of these are impacts are things that we have to be thinking about and reviewing and preparing for as we think about the climate change issue. A couple of maps just to understand, provide an example of why this is important, what we need to look at. Here's the top 25 water ports by tonnage in 2006. Pretty much all of these ports are vulnerable to sea level rise and need to begin to prepare for the impacts of climate change. And even the interior ports need to be concerned about changes in stream flow, changes in precipitation, changes in temperature that are expected due to climate change. Rob Hyman's going to talk a lot more about the Gulf Coast region in his presentation, but just one map just to give you a sense of rail volume and capacity in 2035. You can see in this slide in the blue, those are areas that are vulnerable to 2 or 4 feet of sea level rise. You can see the number of rail lines and those dots are rail facilities, all of which are potentially impacted by that range of sea level rise, which if we don't reduce greenhouse gas emissions and we don't do some adaptation activities, could very well be inundated by climate change. Federal Highways tried to get a sense of what's going on, what's happening in the state of the practice in a number of different activities. I want to talk a little bit about what we found. We surveyed state DOTs to try and understand what kinds of adaptation activities are underway at state DOTs, and what we found is that there are significant inconsistencies across states and regions, including MPOs, in their goals and in their action plans on climate change. The action plans generally stop at a state or MPO boundaries, and certainly the greenhouse gas emissions and climate change impacts don't recognize those boundaries. In terms of climate change action plans, which many states, if not all states, have in place, the DOTs are sometimes not a part of those state-level action plans and strategy developments. which means a number of things to the DOTs. It means, one, that they don't know what the goals are necessarily that are in those plans, don't have an opportunity to discuss what the goals should be. And in some cases, some of those goals that are set are extremely difficult to achieve, perhaps even unrealistic, in terms of the contribution that the transportation sector can make to the overall greenhouse gas emissions analysis within a particular state. It's important that we be part of the debates that are going on right now. And most of the focus of the state, as I said before, has been on greenhouse gas mitigation, with little comprehensive assessment or action on the adaptation side of the coin. We did survey specifically about adaptation in 2008 and found that there were only about 13 states that had activities and actions taking place, and another 15 or so with activities or actions under discussion. Federal Highways working with our partners at state DOTs and at MPOs in order to try and move those numbers and get promote the discussion of adaptation actions that need to take place in terms of preparing for climate change. What are some of those adaptation options that need to be discussed? Well, they generally fall into four categories. One thing we can do is what we've been doing so far. We can continue to try and maintain and manage our existing transportation infrastructure. That's going to mean higher maintenance costs, and in some cases it's going to be a significant challenge to try and maintain what we've got. Another option is to protect and strengthen. There's certainly a lot of that that's happened already and will continue. Seawalls, buffers, and design changes that might make for bigger stormwater pipes, higher bridges that would better withstand changes that will occur. Other options are relocation. You can see a map in California, a proposed relocation of US 1, moving the key facilities rather than trying to rebuild them in place. And in some cases, we may need to promote redundancy in the system so that if one portion of the system goes down for a period of time, there are options so that we can continue to reach people, continue to provide the access and the economic development that the transportation system provides for our country. Alaska is a leader in the adaptation activities, partly by default. They have to be. They've been subject to an awful lot of climate change. They've seen a loss of shore-fast sea ice in climate change in the coastal regions already, as well as melting permafrost, and these pose major threats to infrastructure. You can see a picture of the loss of a significant portion of the coast in a particular storm, and that breakaway basically happened over about an hour or two. The governor has established a state-level adaptation advisory group, including a focus on public infrastructure. And examples of some of the adaptation activities include shoreline protection programs, evacuation route planning and adjustment, relocation in some cases of at-risk infrastructure and communities. There are discussions going on in Alaska, in Louisiana, and some other states about whether or not we need to really pick up communities and move them from where they are now, because there's simply no way to protect them from what's going to happen. In Alaska, they're looking at permafrost protection, as well as expanded and enhanced data collection and collaboration. California also has a number of activities on adaptation. They've been a national leader in addressing mitigation and are moving to adaptation issues as well. They've got a plan for sea level rise, shifting precipitation, extreme weather events, and they're working on that now. Their climate change action plan includes adaptation options, and they develop a statewide information strategy to support infrastructure vulnerability assessment. Probably an assessment that we recommend all states consider, really taking a hard look at where your infrastructure is, what you have, try and get an understanding of potential climate change impacts and determine what is vulnerable to those impacts, those potential impacts, so that you can determine and prioritize what kinds of actions need to take place. What are the implications of adaptation in decision making? Well, there are implications for every stage of the transportation decision making process, whether it's in transportation planning, engineering and NEPA, design and construction, or operations and maintenance. We always need to be, at every step, we need to be thinking about climate change and how we can adapt to the climate change we can reasonably expect it to occur. In some cases, that may be changing design standards. For example, if a current practice is designed for a 50-year event, in many cases, we are seeing that 50-year event happen frequently, multiple times in a single year in some cases, and we may need to change that design event. or update what the definition or the factors are in considering a 50-year storm. And we need to adopt risk-based design approaches, assigning risk for different scenarios, developing multiple designs, and making decisions in a risk analysis framework where we really understand what's the potential for a particular design or particular scenario to happen, a particular design to be vulnerable to future climate change, and make our decisions based on that information. Federal Highway has a number of activities underway in order to address these issues, in order to provide some information and help to state DOTs and MPOs that are struggling with some of these decisions. We are developing a strategy to address adaptation to climate change effects. We will be creating an interim framework to conduct the assessments of transportation infrastructure that I just talked about that will address climate change impacts that can be reasonably be assumed by practitioners, include data needs, gaps, and other considerations. And as we move forward with that framework, which we hope to have available in a draft form in the next several months, we're looking to pilot the framework for conducting the assessments with a number of states or MPOs, construction districts that are interested in addressing these issues and may have made some progress already. We want to try and pilot that framework and make sure that it really is effective and is working. So if anyone is interested in partnering with us on conducting vulnerability assessments, I ask you to please get in touch with me after this presentation so we can work on that in the future. We're also developing guidelines for consideration of climate change impacts and adaptation in the project development and environmental review process. We're coordinating our activities across the federal government, especially with some of the climate agencies such as NOAA and the National Weather Service and the new National Climate Service, should that come into place, so that we're getting the most up-to-date science and information about what potential climate change may occur, and so that we can then assess the potential impacts on our transportation infrastructure. We're active with NCHRP and their Climate Change and Highway Infrastructure Impacts and Adaptation Approaches Report. This is a significant study that the Transportation Research Board is conducting on impacts and adaptation. Rob Hyman's going to talk in just a moment about Gulf Coast Study Phase 1, where we took a look at potential impacts in the Gulf Coast region. We're going to be following that study up with a more detailed look in a particular community or MPO area or city within the Gulf Coast the Gulf Coast region to try and do detailed vulnerability assessments and analyses on the entire transportation system, again, to try and demonstrate how you go about doing these things, evaluate how you can do the vulnerability assessment and use it in the decision-making process, and that study should get underway in the next few months. And as we move with all of this, we're always looking at our federal highway regulations and considering any updates that are necessary in order to help all of you focus on climate change, both mitigation and adaptation issues. I'll wrap up at this point and just give you a couple of resources for some more information. You can see some of the websites available. The USDOT has a Transportation and Climate Change Clearinghouse where you'll be able to find all of these reports and more information. Federal Highway maintains its own climate change website, Highways and Climate Change, and you've got the URL there. And last December, we conducted it with AASHTO, a adaptation peer exchange report. The examples I cited from Alaska and California came out of that peer exchange where we talked to 11 or 12 state DOTs about what they're doing on adaptation activities, and you've got the link to that peer exchange report. I didn't update this slide to indicate a new report that just came out, was released yesterday by the U.S. Global Change Research Program, called Global Climate Change Impacts in the United States. This is a government-wide, sector-wide report about how the climate has already changed, likely changes in the future, and impacts throughout the United States. So I encourage you to search the web or go to climatechange.gov for the Global Climate Change Impacts in the United States report that was done by about a dozen or so federal agencies and was released yesterday. Laura, I'll stop here, and we can turn this over to the other speakers.
Great. Thank you, Rob, and thank you for those of you that posted questions. We will address your questions at the end of the seminar. We will now move on to Rob Hyman of Cambridge Systematics. So, Rob, when you're ready, you can get started.
Great. Thanks a lot, Rob, for introducing my presentation. So that took care of some issues on my end. What we're going to talk about, this Gulf Coast study, is something that is on the adaptation side of the equation that Rob talked about when he referred to, you know, your mitigation, reducing, which is reducing emissions, and then adaptation, which is the other side. How do you deal with climate impacts? What this study really is a case study of some of those climate impacts that Rob Ritter discussed in a more general sense. A case study of one specific region, the Gulf Coast region of the United States. The official name of the study was very long but very descriptive, Impacts of Climate Change and Variability on Transportation Systems and Infrastructure, Phase 1. A little bit about why we started this study. This was, by the way, this is a DOT USGS study. And when we started it, the concept was that little research had been done at that point on transportation impacts compared to the amount of work that had been done on mitigation, that is the amount of work that had been done on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And the idea is that transportation infrastructure is really built for the long haul. And so as the climate changes, the infrastructure may need to evolve to these changing conditions. And so the idea was to do a study of one particular region and see just what those impacts would really mean. The Gulf Coast region was chosen for the study. The study area was essentially a coastal swath of the central Gulf Coast region, stretching from Houston, Galveston on the left, through the New Orleans area in the center, and all the way over to Biloxi and Mobile, Alabama. It's a four-state region, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. So why study the Gulf Coast in particular? The Gulf Coast is actually, especially from a freight point of view, a very nationally significant area. 60% of the nation's petroleum imports come in through the Gulf Coast area, and 40% of the U.S. marine tonnage is carried through the area. It has inland waterways with outlets in the area serve 20 states in the United States, and you can see that on the right side of this slide, and carries 90% of the U.S. inland waterway tonnage. Six out of seven of the Class 1 railroads come through the area, and there's a major east-west interchange point in New Orleans where the Western Railroads and the Eastern Railroads interchange their cars. It has four out of five of the top tonnage ports, you know, 17,000 miles of highway, 56 million passengers at its three largest airports. So what we did in this study was we took a look at essentially four major climate impacts that we decided were the ones with really the most significant impacts for this area. And those were sea level rise, increased storm surge and storm intensity, changes in temperature, and changes in precipitation. We were lucky enough to be working with some very good scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey. And so we were able to come up with some very sophisticated modeling projections. The way these projections were done was what was called an ensemble approach, which is to say we took the results of 21 different climate models in order to statistically average these results together to come up with a range of temperature and sea level rise increases that we might expect over the next 50 to 100 years. What we found is that a few different findings. One is that, you know, temperature is going to go up. That's a very robust finding, which is to say that's something that all the models were in agreement on. Temperatures are likely to increase 1 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit over the next 50 years. What's more significant than the average increases, as far as transportation is concerned, is the increase in the number of very hot days, the extreme temperatures. The number of very hot days could increase, which is to say days over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, could increase as much as 50%. Extreme daily high temps are also increasing with a greater than 50% chance of 21 days each year exceeding 100 degrees Fahrenheit. This is within the next 50 years. As far as precipitation, the models showed more mixed results, which is to say some models showed increases in annual rainfall, some models showed decreases. What is a much more robust finding is that the intensity of rainfall events is likely to increase. We also came up with numbers for sea level rise and hurricane vulnerability. Sea level rise is again a robust finding. The projections show that relative sea level rise in the area will increase 1 to 6 feet. Why do we say relative sea level rise? That includes both what we think of as sort of traditional sea level rise, which is to say thermal expansion of the Earth's oceans as they warm up, and the increase in sea level due to melting ice, melting glaciers. The Central Gulf Coast is fortunate enough to have another problem, which is subsidence, the sinking of the land masses in the Gulf Coast. This is a natural process that's been happening over time as the sediments deposited by the Mississippi and the other river systems in the area slowly compact over time. But it is something that will worsen their vulnerability to sea level rise. Hurricane vulnerability. Hurricane vulnerability is obviously high in that area already. It's something that's likely to worsen over time with an increase in storm intensity. And this is due essentially to changes in the sea surface temperature in the Gulf of Mexico, as shown in that graph, which have been trending upwards over the years. One thing to note about these impacts, the timing of the impact is not clear. You know, we've referenced 50 and 100 years. In fact, there's also the possibility of abrupt changes in the system. Thresholds in the climate system are not well understood at this point. So that's something that we have to be cognizant of. So what does this have implications for? Essentially for all modes in the region, highways, rail, ports and waterways, airports, pipelines, emergency management, as well as long-range planning and investment. And what we've done is we essentially took our analysis and overlaid it on infrastructure maps of the region to see what this would mean. What we have here is a map of what would 4 feet of relative sea level rise mean to the region. On the left side, you can see the present day. The areas in red are areas below sea level. Even in the present day, there are some areas below sea level, with, of course, the most significant one being the New Orleans area right there. But if we have 4 feet of relative sea level rise, you can see that the area underwater expands considerably. Most significantly, the Louisiana Delta is a very low-lying region, clearly the whole area around New Orleans, and much of the coast all the way along. This is, of course, the Galveston area over here. There's a few caveats I do need to say about these findings. This analysis of impacts is based on land elevation rather than the height of facilities. That data was not actually readily available and illustrates some of the data issues planners will face in attempting to deal with climate impacts. We didn't consider the presence of levees and seawalls. Again, it was a lack of good data. But it is important to realize that, given the connectivity of the intermodal system, even having one segment flooded can render much of your infrastructure network inoperable or block access to it. Many transportation facilities depend on local roads, which are typically not elevated, even if the interstate is. So you could easily have a situation in which your highway is out of reach of the water, but all the entrance and exit ramps are not. So there's potentially a lot of issues there. Here, since we're talking about freight, is a similar map for ports. Robert, I think I'd shown something like this as well. And it shows the distribution of ports throughout the system. But also, you can see that essentially all of the ports in the area are vulnerable to sea level rise in one way or another. And this may not be the wharfs, which may be perfectly adequately elevated, but in many cases, the land side structures, the terminals, the warehouses, those sorts of things are not elevated or protected and are at risk to sea level rise. What does this mean overall? About a quarter of the interstate miles and 28% of the arterial miles are at risk from flooding. It comes out to about 2,400 miles of roadway. And that is not including local collector roads. We only looked at the interstate and arterial miles. About three quarters of the port facilities, almost 10% of the rail miles operated and 20% of the freight facilities. Three airports are vulnerable to a sea level rise of 4 feet. And there's also the issue that you could have temporary flooding in low-lying areas increasing as you have this increase in precipitation intensity. It'll be compounded by the rising sea levels, which will, of course, make it harder for the water to drain off the land. Now let's talk about hurricane vulnerability. This picture is, of course, probably a familiar one from Hurricane Katrina. It's the Highway 90 bridge at Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. What it illustrates, of course, is the effect of storm surge and wind, which can be incredibly powerful effects from hurricanes. So we did a similar analysis here, and what we've looked at is the vulnerability to a storm surge of 18 feet. So what is 18 feet? That's equivalent to a strong Category 4 storm or a Category 5 storm. By comparison, Hurricane Katrina came ashore with a maximum storm surge of almost 28 feet. So 18 feet is not such an extreme assumption by any stretch of the imagination. This map shows freight rail lines that are vulnerable to a storm surge of 18 feet. And it's interesting to compare this with what actually happened during Katrina. This area over here, about 30 miles of track in this area were washed out during Hurricane Katrina. And it took CSX 6 months and $250 million to repair it. And in addition, the major interchange point in the New Orleans area was underwater as a result of the storm. And you can see that you have this confluence of lines from the different six Class 1 railroads that have tracks in the area. And they essentially all come through this vulnerable area. So all are at risk. In terms of total numbers, what does this mean? About half of the interstate miles, more than half of the arterial miles at risk, again, to an 18-foot storm surge. Virtually all of the port facilities, and that's probably not a surprise to anyone. A third of the rail miles operated, 40% of the rail freight facilities. 22 airports in the study area are at or below 18 feet of mean sea level, and or 18 feet of elevation, rather. And, you know, airports, and I'm sure we're all aware of this, are typically built in coastal areas or wetlands, areas that weren't wanted for whatever reason or offered, you know, or were flat. So they're particularly vulnerable. And there is also potential damage to offshore facilities, which is to say offshore pipeline facilities. There's also impacts from temperature and precipitation. Clearly, sea level rise and hurricane vulnerability are really the heavy hitters here. But for the freight network, there's also implications for maintenance and construction practices from high temperatures. You know, you can't put work crews out on very hot days, or you have to limit the amount of time they work. Increased energy consumption for refrigerated storage. For the rail network, there's the issues from a potential rise in rail buckling. But there could be impacts to aircraft performance and runway utilization, although it's likely that aircraft technology will progress fast enough to keep pace with that issue. There's also potential for changes in local and national markets and in travel demand. And this is particularly interesting for this area, which sees a lot of the U.S.'s agricultural output comes through the Mississippi region, through the Mississippi River system, that is. And you could easily imagine that if there's changes in where different agricultural products are grown or produced as, you know, they shift, say, north or west due to changing precipitation patterns or changing temperature patterns, and if the harvest season changes, this could have major impacts on the inland waterway system. You know, if produce comes through when the waterways are low, clearly you have major problems for the freight shipping system, or it could just move elsewhere. Precipitation, of course, also has implications. Really, the main one is in dealing with stormwater, and so there could be changes to stormwater retention and treatment facilities due to the increase in extreme precipitation events. So what are the implications for transportation planning? Well, one of the things to note is that climate change is generally, the impacts of climate change, rather, are generally not considered today in planning, as Robert Ritter noted already. And we have a current practice focused on a 20-year planning, a 20 and 30-year planning horizon, which is not well suited to the assessment of climate impacts. You can see what happens. You know, if we have the current transportation planning process over here, if we start doing engineering and design and construction, we typically base it on historical climate data, which will be from, say, the previous 30-year period. But you can see that if we expect this facility to stay in service for 50 or 60 or 70 years, as can happen with a bridge, which may even be in service for a century, what will happen is that as the service life, as this facility progresses through its service life, it will increasingly be in a climate for which it was not designed. So what can we do to prepare for this? You know, the future is uncertain. You may have noticed that all the numbers they gave you were ranges for expected temperature and expected sea level rise. So we need to be able to have reliability under a range of conditions in order to have a robust transportation system. This suggests some new approaches to decision making might be more helpful here, scenario planning, using probabilistic approaches. We'll need to be able to consider both incremental and abrupt change. And what this leads us is to an approach which Rob Ritter also alluded to, in which we have to have a risk assessment approach that leads us to our adaptation response. This study, the Gulf Coast study that we've talked about here, essentially represents the risk assessment part of this whole area. You know, we've looked at the exposure of this area's transportation infrastructure to climate impacts, you know, how vulnerable it is, some of its resiliency factors. The next step is, of course, deciding what your adaptation response is, and Rob did talk about this in some detail, whether you harden your facilities, whether you promote redundancy, whether you relocate. Once you put in place that adaptation response, it of course leads to greater resilience, but the climate doesn't stop changing. So this becomes a never-ending process. You have to continually update your risk assessments, update your adaptation choices in order to maintain a level of resilience. It's also important as we do this, we don't live in a world of unlimited resources, and so you have to decide where your adaptation dollars should go first. So you also need to have some way of prioritizing what are the most important facilities. You need to have more than just the degree of risk, not just what is most likely to get hit by climate impacts, but also how important these facilities are to your system performance. So you, of course, want to the critical facilities are, of course, those here, the ones that are both high risk and of critical importance, you know, your major bridges, things like that. You need to have some way of prioritizing your adaptation dollars beyond that. There's a good example in California with their seismic bridge retrofits. After the, I believe it was the Loma Prieta earthquake of 1989, they decided they wanted to retrofit all their bridges to be able to withstand earthquakes. But they had an inventory of literally thousands of bridges in their system. And so the question became how to assign where the dollars should go first. And they came up with an whole algorithm based on the vulnerability of the various bridges to earthquake disasters, how critical they were. You know, they come up with different levels of resiliency that were needed. For instance, the Oakland Bay Bridge, they wanted to make sure that didn't fall down during an earthquake, and they wanted it to be reopened within 24 hours. You know, a more minor bridge maybe could be reopened within 6 months. And we'll need to start developing this kind of mindset as well in order to deal with climate impacts. The study that we've talked about is available on the web. It was done under the auspices of the Climate Change Science Program, so you'll see it there on that climatescience.gov website. You can also, of course, contact me with any additional questions about it. And with that, I will turn it back over to Laura.
Thank you, Rob. Our final presentation will be given by Alan Clark of the Houston-Galveston Area Council. Let me just pull up your presentation. Alan, there you go. So we'll hand it over to you. Alan, are you still on the line with us?
I'm sorry, now can you hear me?
Now we can hear you, thank you.
Thank you very much, yes, I'll unmute myself. since we got started at the Houston-Galveston Area Council back in 1966, our organization has provided a venue for local governments to respond cooperatively to regional challenges. In November of 2007, HJC's Board of Directors established an expert panel to develop recommendations for local governments to adapt to potential changes in the region's climate and the associated environmental effects. This foresight panel, as it was known, was charged to recommend sound strategies to local governments to adapt to the potential effects of climate change should they occur. You can see from the nature of the panel, it had a variety of both academic, government, transportation persons covering a wide range of disciplines from policy, engineering, climate change, geoscience, flood control, etc. We worked from much of the material that you saw presented earlier, particularly the Gulf Coast study. From that study, we attempted to pull some of the major climate effects that could be faced by our region. Summarized here, you see four of the principal ones. the temperature increase, sea level rise, periods of both drought and the potential for heavy rainfall events, and the possibility of increased intensity, if not frequency, of hurricanes and tropical storms. When we look at our region and consider a 5-foot level increase in sea level, and remember that's a combination of increase in actual water height, but also the fact that our region experiences some of the greater rates of subsidence in the Gulf Coast region. The heavy blue areas on this map, let's see if I can get the pointer to work. Is my pointer working? The heavy blue areas on this map show those that would be inundated by a 5-foot sea level rise. We zoom in a bit to one of our areas. If I can get my pointer to behave. Here you can see the area that includes the port of Freeport, one of the region's fastest growing water ports. This heavy blue line that you see is the alignment of the Gulf Coast Intracoastal Waterway, which not only serves Texas, but the entirety of the Gulf Coast, and was the principal routes for the movement of barge traffic in our region. That too would be at great risk to such a level of sea level rise. The report, in terms of its recommendations, looked at four major strategies that we could employ. And these, again, are very similar to what you heard in earlier presentations. The first strategy is managing the facilities that we have, also the strategy that we can perhaps implement the soonest. One of the things that we looked at were effects that were not only to infrastructure, but the potential effects on human health and welfare and emergency management types of activities. One of the keys to dealing in this area is to strengthen the mutual aid agreements between our local governments, especially when it comes to major weather events. Not everybody's going to be equally affected at the same time, even in an event such as a hurricane. So the first resources you can bring to deal with the situation are those that you have in neighboring communities. But as our region continues to grow, and we're anticipating the addition of another 3 to 3.5 million people in the next 20 to 25 years, we need to make sure that this new growth happens in a way that it's going to be more survivable from major storm events and avoids some of the impacts of climate change. One of the comments made earlier is that in transportation planning, we have traditionally looked at a 20 to 30 year time period. In some cases, with a visioning exercise, we might look as far as 50 years into the future. But with climate change, we need to have a much longer vision. The Foresight Report looks at conditions as they might be in at the end of the decade, in 2100. Many of the transportation infrastructure investments, as was said, will not only in and of themselves have a potential life of 50 or maybe even 100 years, but the land use changes resulting from those decisions will have a very long lifetime. And then recovery and reconstruction, one of the key areas that our report focused on is how can we finance the recovery process. Insurance, FEMA, and other financial resources that you might be aware of are not only inadequate for the scale of reinvestment that's often needed, but sometimes are limited to your ability to do more than simply replace what facility you lost. Here are some of the management strategies that were identified in the report. I'm not going to read all these, but the report took a very sort of ground level approach to this, in that we still think that historical data is useful, but who now want to introduce some of the information from climate change in that decision making. There's some very short-term things that local governments can do to help mitigate effects of climate change, like heat wave management plans. We've just had, I think, 5 or 6 days of 98 degrees already in our region. And then, although the principal focus of this report was adaptation, we are looking for those strategies which can also have the benefit of reducing the contributing factors to climate change, particularly greenhouse gas emissions. Some things that we're looking at in terms of growth, our recent experience with Hurricane Ike certainly illustrated the dramatic difference between structures that had been developed with modern design standards and construction methods, as opposed to older structures which were far less survivable. Reinvestment is a decision which is often linked to significant and community-changing kinds of activities. Today, the city of Galveston, for example, is trying to consider how it should not only restore the damage that's occurred, but how it should look to grow in the future. Their reinvestment strategies are not only going to take this longer-term view of the infrastructure, but I think we're also looking at infrastructure in a connected and broader way. For example, how will the transportation infrastructure be affected by the loss of electrical power to an area? Often the roads can be unblocked, can be passable, but if we don't have the power to turn on the traffic lights at the intersection, how do we operate them safely? And then in the recovery process, we're asking ourselves, as a regional council of governments, how we can assist our local governments both in response to climate change and planning for these changes. In fact, in that regard, a rather simplistic idea of how we'd like to do this, in that planning obviously should be an immediate and early activity that's used to develop guidance documents as climate change, as we respond to climate change, and as we attempt to give direction to future growth. The investment in things like transportation infrastructure would need to follow in a way consistent with that planning process. One of the most significant decisions would be a decision to relocate some elements, for example, of the transportation infrastructure because of their significant potential impact on land use. Not all transportation infrastructure has the same impact, but for example, if we were to consider relocating Interstate 10 to the north of the current location, closer, say, to the original US 98 alignment, that would have far-reaching and dramatic impacts across all of our local governments. One thing I'd say about this chart is it's extremely optimistic. And if we, as we've learned with Hurricane Ike, sometimes the logical sequence for planning, for investment, and for major decisions like relocation can be compressed into the immediate here and now as a consequence of Mother Nature. We're continuing the work following our development of this initial effort with some of the activities you see here. I think I'll mention briefly the last one, working with the Texas A&M Bush School. They've been actually discussing with elected leadership in our region and others their knowledge of climate change, of the work of the Foresight Panel, and any changes in or new decision-making that has occurred as a consequence of that, or actions they may have initiated. I think one important factor for us to keep in mind is that it's very difficult for local governments to get their hands around these decisions. Their time frame for most decision-making is very short-term. Usually their capital improvements programs extend out only 5 or 6 years. And despite their general knowledge of of climate change. It's very difficult for us, for them to put this into a into their normal decision-making processes. Our foresight report's available here at this website location, and look forward to hearing your questions. Laura, I'll turn the presentation back to you.
Thank you, Alan, and thank you all for posting questions. I will note that Diane Trichetta from FHWA has been posting some responses into the chat box for us, so we will quickly skim over the summaries of some of her responses as well as we're going through these. But I do turn your attention to the chat box, so some of your questions may have been answered by Diane, so thank you, Diane, for handling that. So we will start, we'll start at the top with questions for Rob Ritter. The first question being, the assessments that Rob Ritter mentioned to be used for climate change and infrastructure, are those studies eligible for FHWA funding?
Yes. There, as you all know, I'm sure there's a variety of different types of federal aid funding, all of which comes with its own rules, requirements, matching requirements, and other uses, but assessment studies certainly are eligible for various categories of federal funds, and if you have specific questions about how to go about that and what you can use, I encourage you to check with your Federal Highway Division office. I do happen to know that Bethany, who asked that question, is in one of our Federal Highway Division offices, so I will follow up with you, Bethany, and we can provide you some additional feedback to work with your DOT and your MPOs as they're doing those assessments.
Okay, we had one question which I believe that Diane has addressed, but I'll just quickly read through it here. Are we still using the pre-recession predictions for the 2035 levels of freight demand? For example, as shown in your map with the level of service F level for rail in much of the Gulf Coast area.
Yeah, this is Diane. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you, Diane, okay. for jumping in.
Sure. I just wanted to say while we were online, I checked with our freight operations office, and the forecasts, they're using our prior to the recession. And like I said in the answer, we'll check to them to see if they're going to revise any of those forecasts based on, you know, the economic downturn. But as it stands right now, those forecasts are prior to the recession.
Okay, thank you. I forgot that you were on the phone with us, so I'm glad that you were able to jump in and stop me from having to repeat what you've already said much better than I could.
And Laura, this is Rob Ritter. Just a quick thank you to the new climate change team, and especially to Diane Trichetta, who really helped to put together the presentation that I went over today. So thank you, Diane, and thanks for your help with answering these questions.
Okay, so our next question is, if there is a 50-year event is happening every 3 years, then how is a 50-year event defined, and should the 50-year event be redefined?
That's a very good question that we are asking as well. I'm not a hydraulics person. I can't tell you how the 50-year event is defined, but one of the things we are starting to think about is whether or not we need to be redefining that 50-year event. And we're working with the other federal agencies to look into those kinds of questions right now and to think about how we need to do those definitions and how future climate change might play into some of those definitions as well, and whether or not those definitions change, how does that impact the standards or the practices that we advocate here at Federal Highway? Again, this is Rob Ritter responding to that question.
And this is Rob Hyman. I'll just add to that. As far as how it's defined, that's based on historical data. You know, what have the rainfall events been for the past 50 years or the past 100 years, however long the data goes back. And of course, that's why, as the climate changes, it becomes less and less accurate for today's world.
Thanks, Rob. And we did have Ralph Rizzo was nice enough to give you guys all the link for the report that Rob Ritter mentioned at the end of his presentation. So that link is provided for you in the chat box, so you can access that if that's something you're interested in looking at. Our next question is, in the state of Alaska, a few coastal communities have been relocated in association with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Not really a question, more of just an FYI for you guys to know that that is something that's going on in Alaska. So we'll go on to a quick note about the website that Rob mentioned, giving the details of what was on that website. Rob, did you want to
I think
add
Diane
to this?
Again saved the day here and responded with an updated URL on where you can find the the report for that climate change adaptation peer exchange. So thank you again, Diane.
Oh, yeah.
Sure, and we'll get that posted to our climate change website so that connection's obvious.
Okay, and we had a question of whether or not the statistics that Rob Hyman was cited were based on the study area or whether they were nationwide, and I believe that they are study area limited just to the study area.
Yeah, that's correct. Those were for that, I think it was a 48-county study area that we did, and all statistics were completely for that area.
Okay, so our next question, is it anticipated that the new federal transportation authorization will include funding to port authorities for physical and programmatic solutions to address their vulnerabilities to climate change and mitigate some of their role in climate change? And I'll open that to any of the presenters, and Diane, if you would like to respond.
I'm not sure if we can speak to exactly what's going to be in the transportation authorization, but all of these issues are certainly being debated within the administration and within Congress right now, whether some of these questions get answered in the transportation authorization or if they get answered or addressed in the climate change debate, and especially the Waxman-Markey bill that's under debate in Congress right now. I couldn't say, but I think those kinds of issues about how we provide the funding and what's required in terms of planning and addressing for these climate change impacts, those questions and debates are going on right now, but I don't think we have answers yet.
Yeah, let me just add to that. This is Diane. That you see further down there in the box, that Kathleen Bailey of EPA provided a URL for a report that EPA did, really a white paper on planning for climate change impacts on U.S. ports. Now, of course, that doesn't answer your reauthorization question, as Rob explained. We don't really know that, but it does highlight the connection between ports and climate change and the impacts that are expected.
Sorry, it's technical issues by the user, which would be me, if you're seeing the chat box going up and down all over your screen. So I apologize for that, folks. So we will jump right back into the questions now that we're back in control here. And we had a question which I think Diane has also kind of addressed a little bit. Does anyone have a nationwide map listing or listing showing all of the seaports and how they would be affected at various levels of sea rise? And I believe that we definitely do have maps showing all the seaports in the U.S., and we could overlay the seaport map with information related to 2 or a 4-foot sea level rise, as well as a storm surge, if there's anything else anyone would like to add to that.
Yeah, this is Diane. I just thought we could, as I said, we certainly have all the seaports listed in U.S. Mass Maritime Administration or the Freight Office, I think, has them, and we could overlay that with some of the information from the Gulf Coast study, the maps that Rob Hyman presented, and kind of get an idea of, what the ports look like with storm surge and sea level rise.
This is Alan Clark. The only thing I'd add to that is, it's my understanding that the West Coast ports, for example, could be in a very different situation because, as opposed to subsidence, they experience, in some cases, elevation of the land area. So it's not quite as simple as simply saying the water would be this much higher for everywhere.
Right. Thank you for that, Alan. Thanks for reminding me.
Okay, we had a request to please recommend reports or resources that would be appropriate for states located in the interior, i.e. the West and the Midwest. So I'm sure the presenters and folks on the call can follow up with Merle to maybe provide some recommendations.
And I think this is Rob Ritter. The websites that we've mentioned, the DOT Climate Change Clearinghouse has a number of reports. You want to take a look at that. One that I don't think has been mentioned yet that's would probably be worthwhile is the National Academy of Sciences report on climate change and adaptation, report 290, where they went through a wide variety of potential climate change impacts and what that means to a broad range of transportation infrastructure, both on the coast and in the interior. So you might want to take a look at National Academy of Sciences report 290 as well.
Great. Thank you, Rob. And then similar to the assessment funding question, what are the likely funding sources for the necessary adaptation studies and projects?
This is Rob Rutter again. At the moment, there aren't specific funding sources specific to adaptation studies and projects, and I don't know if there would be programs that are designed specifically for that. But as I mentioned in my presentation, we need to be considering adaptation at every point in our transportation decision-making process, and we've got funding for each of those points. So whether you're considering adaptation in the planning process and you're using your standard planning funds to address adaptations there, whether you're designing a new project and you're considering whether or not you want to use a 50-year storm event or a different storm event, when you're considering what's the appropriate design for a project, you've got federal aid funding available to do that design, operations and maintenance, the same sorts of issues. I don't expect a specific pot, but various existing funding sources are available for these activities.
So we do have a little bit of time, so I will ask that Sue, our operator, come on and explain how to ask a question. Before she does that, I will bring up some pictures from Hurricane Ike that Alan Clark had provided. I'll just scroll through them as she's giving you the instructions on how to ask a question over the phone if you would like to do that, so you can kind of see some of the impacts of a storm like Hurricane Ike.
Thank you. And at this time, if you would like to ask a question over the phone lines, please press *1 on your touchtone phone. Please unmute your phone and record your first and last name when prompted. Your name is required in order to introduce your question. To withdraw your request, press *2. One moment, please. The first question comes from Caitlin Hughes. You may go ahead with your question.
Hi, this is Caitlin Hughes-Raymond from the Maryland Department of Transportation. I had a follow-up question to my request for an overlay of sea level rise on ports across the nation, and that is, could we try to do something similar on the rail side? I'd love to see the rail lines and their potential areas of concern based on sea level rise.
Yeah, Caitlin, this is Diane. The one slide that Rob had did overlay that in the Gulf Coast region. We didn't do it for the whole United States, but that would be something, you know, we could look into.
Sure. I think especially as it pertains to nationwide vision for freight, it'd be really important to see what parts of the country are more compromised than others.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you.
Thank you. And at this time, there are no further audio questions. As a reminder to ask a question, that is *1.
We did have a quick request if you could, Rob, repeat the answer about redefining a 50-year event that you gave earlier.
Sure, I can try to. I won't repeat it exactly. You'll have to go back to the audio recording for that. But my point was that a lot of designs are based on 50-year and 100-year storm events. As Rob Hyman indicated, those 50-year and 100-year are based on historical data. We're seeing changes based due to the greenhouse gases. We're seeing changes to precipitation that are not straight line changes from historical events, and we're not seeing the same kinds of storms, the same intensity or even frequency of storms in some cases that we had seen for the last 50 or 100 years. So it may be appropriate to not use the 50-year event in some particular cases, and we are certainly at Federal Highway talking with some of the other federal agencies to do some evaluations of what the 50-year or 100-year event should be considered, and whether or not we should be updating that information so that as you're moving forward and making decisions about designs or changes to existing infrastructure, you're using perhaps different information. That all is ongoing now. I mean, as you all can appreciate, I'm sure there's a lot of ramifications to those changes, and so we want to make sure that we're using the appropriate science, have the most up-to-date information, and are appreciating all of those ramifications as we make these decisions and put out information for you.
Okay, with that, I think we are through all of the questions that were typed in and questions over the phone. So thank you all for attending today's seminar. The recorded version of this event will be available within the next week on the Talking Freight website. I'd just like to give a brief mention here about the FHWA Freight Peer-to-Peer Program. The Freight Peer-to-Peer Program puts the public sector freight transportation professionals in touch with experts in the field and provides technical assistance in order to enhance overall freight skills and knowledge. The program is available to public entities, including state departments of transportation and MPOs. To learn more about the program or to arrange a peer exchange or discuss participating as a peer expert, please visit the Freight Peer-to-Peer website. The next Talking Freight seminar will be held on July 15th and will be about the credit crunch and impacts on freight transportation. If you haven't done so already, I encourage you to visit the Talking Freight website and sign up for this seminar. The address is up on the screen, coming up on your screen now. And I also encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv if you've not done so already. So with that, please enjoy the rest of your day.